Action.
Okay, so I want to do today is go primarily through Rav Yisraeli's piece carefully and talk about it entirely objectively to begin with. Right? What are his arguments? Do you follow his arguments? Do you buy his arguments? And then at the end, I want to shift out of objectivity and say, just are we comfortable with that conclusion? Right? Is that a way? Right? Is that the kind of rationale on the basis of which we w on the basis of which we're willing to paskin or not, based on much broader prior commitments? Okay, so let's take right. Let's put Rav Yisraeli in context. Okay, so Rav Yisraeli is writing a very large article which becomes famous or infamous for many years, right? Which is an attempt to justify reprisal raids. Reprisal raids against villages which harbored, possibly enthusiastically, Palestinian terrorists, even if those reprisal raids involve the killing of non of what we shall frame as non-immediate combatants. Okay, so I don't need to right, I don't need to bias the political discussion. The specific context is, I believe, is some kind of reprisal, Israeli reprisal raid against the village Kiviyah, right? I forget where that was, which involved the killing of any number of civilians, all of whom could plausibly be seen as part of the terrorist infrastructure, if you wanted to. Okay, now that's a background. Okay, and I would, while I have lots of issues with that article per se. Those issues tend to be right. Those issues are belong largely in the context of the discussion of military ethics bichlal, and that's not the conversation this summer. Those who are interested in that topic, you can read my exchange with Rabbi Michael Broy, which you have to anyway if you want to get into Chovei, apparently. Right, since it's the admissions interview. You can read the broad conversation about this. It would be fair to say that Reb Roy's position seems largely shared by Rav Yisraeli, even though ironically Rav Yisraeli begins with a statement of how unique Mishpatei Torah have to be, built on Rachamim and things like that. It sort of interests me as a sort of irony. Okay, in the context, right, in the context of that broader discussion, and I should say, that my Israeli theories have a certain amount of appeal to me if you could divorce them from some of the conclusions. Say, for example, Israeli's conception of Malchus, which we'll talk about here, is exactly the same as mine. And actually, one of my hesitations of citing him as precedent for the piece of, for the argument I want to make is that he comes to such radically different conclusions from on the basis of the same Lamdish argument than I do. But okay, so what he needs to do in the context of this article is he has to find a way in which it is legitimate to kill people in war. Right, because we start with a prima facie problem. Right? The prima facie problem is war involves killing people, and you have the option of not going to war. Okay, and particularly, he's talking about reprisal raids, and so he understands that it's plausible for people to view these reprisal raids as milchemet reshut as opposed to milchemet mitzvah. Milchemet mitzvah, particularly if you view milchemet mitzvah as a milchemet mitzvah of self-defense, so then you can just use rodeis and go home. Right? You can find some way to develop a broad category of rodeis. But when you're talking about a milchemet reshut, you're talking about a raid which is a reprisal as opposed to a direct act, right, where they're attacking you. Right?
Exactly, does reprisal like.
Right, so a bunch of terrorists came and killed some of your civilians. So you go and attack the village, which houses those. You may be trying to get those terrorists specifically, but it's not because they're trying to kill you now. And in the process, they're likely to be civilian casualties, none of whom pose a direct threat to you.
So it's for the sake of scaring them into not acting against you?
Largely, yeah. I think it's a fair thing, We certainly wouldn't be happy admitting that it was about revenge. Right? Although you might want to legitimate revenge also.
So revenge was so well.
Yeah, I mean, what your motives are, I don't know. But, and at the end of the article, he's going to argue that it's all Mechanet Mitzvah. Okay, that issue, the issue of preemptive raids, right, reprisal raids, those are all discussed in much greater length in the context of Milchemet Shalom HaGalil, right, in terms of the First Lebanon War. So all the prior positions that the justifying wars, Israeli wars, kind of were inadequate to cover Milchemet Shalom HaGalil, and so a whole new halachic literature related, either expanding the category of Milchemet Mitzvah greatly, or coming up with permission to engage in Milchemet Rishut, was developed in the reaction to that war. This is before that. As I say, what matters to us is that in that context, he has to develop a theory of how you can kill people, and he's trying to develop a theory of what legitimates war. Right, why is war okay? Why should we not just be pacifists? So his broad theory of what legitimates war is Dina de Malchus Adina. Right, that's the three-word phrase, right? What justifies war? Well, that's what people do. It's war. Right? War is a reasonable way for nations to engage in foreign policy. Right? Continuation of diplomacy by other means. Yes, Tavia.
Yeah, I just don't think that the use of the term Dina de Malchus Adina in this context is correct. In other words, he's using a svara which is also used to legitimate Dina de Malchus Adina, namely the agreement of individuals, or possibly the agreement of a rogue to which an individual is batoted. But the idea is not because I am part of this particular nation, therefore, because this nation is going to war, therefore I have to accept whatever happens in that context, is that there's an assumption, there's an agreement among individual people that in the context of war, this is what's going to happen in war, and this is what is expected.
So tell me again. I'm not sure I get the distinction you're making. You're claiming that it's the same svara, but it's not the same.
I think there are a number of books that are offered for Dina de Malchus Adina. And if you want to have a social contract, King owns the land.
Right. So he's adopting the social contract theory.
But this is a social contract, but it has nothing to do with whatever my particular government feels. It has to do with, this is a global, universal thing that occurs, and I sort of accept that upon myself. But it's not because I'm a member of this particular
Oh, I'm not so sure. That depends. Can I declare a private war according to him?
I think so. I mean, maybe not just because it's not really accepted to have a war between groups which aren't nations, but I don't know. I mean, how do you define a nation?
That's an excellent question. But I think that he is arguing that Dina Malchus Adina, right, that part of the social contract is that we organize ourselves into distinct political groups, and those distinct political groups settle differences among themselves by killing members of the other groups.
But I think that his svara of Hasama could even theoretically apply to a situation where you don't have a nation with a government per se.
That's true. In principle, right? Does he think Dina Malchus Adina has? He thinks Dina Malchus Adina has no specific content. It's just the product of a social contract, and there are social contracts engaged in within nations, and there are social contracts engaged in among nations. If it turns out that the nation state is passe and we all joined the world state, or if we decided that actually every family has its own sovereignty, then Dina Malchus Adina will be different. It happens that we have nations. So that's how Dinochudia functions. Right? I don't think he argues that nations are intrinsic to the notion of war. Unless, I could say, just for quality, there is this wild position of the Rashba that Blake loves quoting, that and maybe the Rashba really means it, he does seem to say it, as far as I recall, that Dina Malchus Adina only applies to structures that existed at the time of Matan Torah. And therefore, possibly the graduated income tax is not legal, halachically. if you can't demonstrate that there was a graduated income tax in place at the time, right, at the time of Matan Torah. Now, if that were the case, you might argue that since the wars at the time of the Gemara were always fought by nations. But that's a hard thing to say, truthfully, because we have Amalek, we have. So if you were to make that claim, right, then within the Rashba you could make the assertion that it was essential. I have a hard time accepting that Rashba, much as Rabbi Leish enjoys it. I enjoy it too, I just have a hard time accepting it. Okay, Rabbi had a question and then Deirdre.
No, I was just saying, it seems like Rishon's Kiddush here is the Dina Malchut of Dina. I think Pashtus is that it applies on a national level, not an international level. And I don't see where he gets that jump, that unless there's some sort of implied social contract among nations.
So that's his dispute with the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya, right, he understands, believes that Dina Malchut of Dina is only an internal concept, and war requires, and relationships among nations requires entirely different structure.
Right.
And his Kiddush is, no, he thinks that Dina Malchus Adina, that the same phenomena, Dina Malchus Adina, that functions both internally and externally. That's the Kiddush, and right, to see if you can structure that or not. I'll go into the tangent now. The Israeli takes the position, so far as I know, there's him, the Maariv Chayyim, and me. I know, Havdil, but wait, we're the, you know, that's the chain of tradition, that the Melech in, the Melech Israel has no powers whatsoever. Right, that the, all there is a social contract. The social contract was negotiated by the Jews of Yehoshua. It was renegotiated by Shmuel. And happily, now that our contract with the king has been abrogated by 2,000 years of destruction, we can make the Mashiach a completely powerless symbolic monarchy if we so choose. Right, I so choose. When Mashiach comes, I will inform him that I am very grateful that he has come, and I am happy to give him the crown and the scepter, and he answers the parliament. I have no interest in developing an absolute monarchy, Mashiach or anyone else. I'm frank about that. You know, that please don't tell Mashiach if he disagrees, because that will be unhealthy for me politically. If he disagrees, very likely it will be very deeply unhealthy to me, because he'll have concepts like Murray Malthus and things like that that he sets up. But the first person to develop this, I believe, is Maariv Chayyim. Maariv Chayyim says that fundamentally there is nothing, and if you read Dvarim, you will discover that Dvarim does not mention any powers of the king at all. Tom Tassim Alecha Melech, and then there's a list of things the king can't do. Right? There is nothing whatsoever in Chumash tells you anything the king can do. And Shetei Matzah Alecha can mean, you know, play pomp and circumstances when he comes in, everyone stands up, and we all behave in the same way we do towards the Queen of England. With great deference. Yes.
Who says that we ever had to have a Melech? I mean, that, you know, it depends on how you read that key, and then the whole thing in Shmuel.
Sure. Even if we pass in the Melech is a Chiyuv, okay?
Okay.
Right. Even if we pass in that Simas Melech is a mitzvah, right? And we look forward to a Mashiach who is Ben David and who wants the crown. I'm perfectly happy to have a Davidic king. I'm not happy to have an autocrat. And right, so when the Davidic king comes, that is my prima facie position, that there is no reason whatsoever that the king should have any powers other than those specifically delegated to the king by the other branches of the government. When we can then talk about how we structure the Sanhedrin. Right, some of you know, right, one of my other shirim is based on a Cook's thesis that the Sanhedrin should be elected. So I have a very democratic messianic era.
How do you prevent the tyranny of the majority?
Ah, well, let's see, so maybe the messianic king will get to decide which party in parliament wins. Maybe he gets to develop, you know. I think the British experience is very useful in this regard. Yes, Mish.
The reason you don't see the ideal as Melech Mashiach, a Melech with the traditionally assumed responsibilities and privileges of a king, because you don't trust a Melech Mashiach.
Absolutely. I think he's human. He's human, he has Yitzhara.
Even in Olam HaMashiach.
Even Olam HaMashiach. I take the Rambam as opposed to the Ramban. But
even in the Ramban holds that there'll be a Yitzhara in Yimos HaMashiach. He just holds there'll be a period 1,000 years later where it'll be not Yimos HaMashiach anymore.
And even that, you know, to me, I talked about this with, I forget who was having the conversation with, Deirdre. Right, that, you know, that to me, the Ramban says that Yimos HaMashiach, we go back to having the snake externalized. Good, but the snake still, they already talked to you. Right, unless there's no Yitzhara. Right, people still have Yitzhara, and if people still have Yitzhara, then power is one of the Yitzhara, And if power is only temporal, then they're going to be corrupted by power. So me, I would, you know, I assume that the Messianic era still has checks and balances. And last I heard, nobody thought the Sanhedrin got eliminated in time of, right? Part of the, in the realm, the Sanhedrin has to pre-exist the appointment of the king. So that's me. Again, this is, I just point out that why I have a lot of affinity. The Israeli social contract model works wonders for me when I'm doing political theory of Judaism. Okay, yes, Deirdre, you're waiting.
I guess I don't understand why we can rely on saying, that because it's the way of the nations of the world to, you know, to foreign policy this way, we do it this way, as opposed to, you know, it's the way of the nations of the world to worship gods via physical agents, or it's the way of people to settle their own disputes via violence, so we just do it that way. So how come we can apply that sort of logic to a grander scale but not on a more individual scale?
So that's a good question. I mean, the second part is where I totally agree. In fact, if the norm in society were to reasonably to kill people as a mode of exacting justice, it seems that he doesn't really have any objection to that.
Well, we see that in literature throughout the ages. I mean, if you read Aeschylus, the whole end of Aeschylus is Athena saying, well, it has been up until this point that the way of settling justice is by exacting revenge through killing people.
Right.
So that won't be anymore.
That's right.
But then we see when, in Huck's Finn, that these families are settling disputes that way for years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of evidence for a long time that this would be the natural way that people settle disputes.
Ah, so now we should be careful about whether natural is not the key, right? It's not a natural law model. It's not that this works because this is the way human beings biologically settle disputes. It's because we agree to settle disputes this way. Right, it's not a rule of nature. It's a social contract, right? It has to be settled. So he's not arguing anything in terms of that. And the same way Athena settles with Aeschylus, God comes and settles it at Sinai for us. Right? So the internal dynamics of the Jewish people, largely, we have created a permanent social contract by accepting Torah. Right? But for the rest of the world, that's not so. And he argues basically Torah doesn't give us so much structure in our relationship with non-Jews. I think that's the way he frames it. Although we'll see about the extent to which the social contract limits relationships among private parties in the Jewish state is not right, or frees them. He doesn't discuss. What I'm telling you is, outside this article, he does believe that the relationship between Jews and their governments is entirely structured by the social contract. So we can we can set whatever relations we want. We can say the king has the right to kill us for saying the wrong thing at court, and we can say the king has no right to kill us unless he produces 150 witnesses, each of whom swear that they watched the murder directly. Right, we have complete freedom that way, and it's a very Zionist position, because what it does is, right, and this is its purpose. What it does is it legitimates the state of Israel, even though the state of Israel doesn't follow halacha. And because if you believe that the only possible samchut for relationships among Jews is Torah, then a state which doesn't use Torah as its basis is illegitimate. But if you believe that, or if you believe that Torah is the only coercive jurisdiction that can happen, that the Jews among themselves can structure their relationships however they wish, unless they come in direct contradiction to something in Torah which goes so far as to say you can't engage in, right, you can't negotiate this away. Now we know in terms of Mamonos you can negotiate almost anything away. Right? So basically he ends up saying that all interpersonal relationships are negotiable. Right? But the state can't legitimate wearing shatnez. Right? So if the state of Israel ever demands shatnez, right, we Zionists are in trouble, right? That's our red line. No shatnez uniform. But if the state wishes to negotiate a criminal legal system which does not depend on eyewitness testimony, or which accepts women as witnesses, we have no objection to that, so long as, right, because if we have a social contract in which every party is hypothetically, right, now, the mechanism by which a social contract is created is, right, why, you know, a social contract is always a fiction, right? You know, sometimes you have these mass conventions. Even in these mass conventions, they often exclude significant parties, like women and, right, and the poor, right, and things like that. But within the, right, but within this hypothetical constitutional convention, right, however that is structured, you can do pretty much whatever you want. And therefore, a Zionist state is perfectly legitimate. Right. So one should not, you know, underestimate the importance of this move. Right. It's a critical Zionist move. And it's one that has a lot of appeal for me in some ways. And freedom always has a price. So the freedom of social contract is that you can also find a really bad social contract. Right? You can find a Hobbesian social contract, which gives the Leviathan state has the right to do whatever the heck it wants. Doesn't have to be. You can find a Rousseauian one in which the will of the people can make you do whatever you want. Right, or you can be lucky and be in Philadelphia in 1776.
So it is a matter of contract. It's not just like, oh, this is what everybody does.
No, no.
Like, it's a common understanding that this is how we're going to contract.
Right. Now the issue is, of course, how you discover what the contract is, since there are always these annoying people who don't seem to behave as if the contract is true. Right. So that's where you come to the concept of butladaito. Right. Those people don't count. Right. Now at what point, how many people don't count? Right, that's a big issue, and people always end up talking about. Now, Israel, you should point out, Israel's big nafkamina nowadays, right, is for the halakhic discussion of whether the state of Israel is bound by international law. Now, the Israeli is usually cited as the position that the state of Israel is bound by international law. But there is the halakhic position that way. But the
Israeli is in favor of giving up all the shekim.
So then, first of all, of course, you can hold Kimli in international law. but the other position is what happens what happens if there's an international law that no one really keeps? They only use it insofar as they can punish other people.
Is there any international law that isn't
active? Right, that's the whole issue, right? So some of the halakhic response to the claim that Israel is bound by international law based on Israeli is that Israel is only bound by actual international law, not by pieces of paper that people sign never intended to keep. Right? Like the notion that Israel is bound to observe fundamental human rights because the Soviet Union signed the Helsinki Accords in 1975. Right, that's ridiculous. Right? The Soviet Union never intended to observe the Helsinki Accords. Right, so that's a big right. So he tells you, right? You know, he tells you that he supports war because no one has yet succeeded in outlawing war. He's aware of the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, which all of you are probably familiar with. That right, the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, but after World War One, which was a negotiated agreement outlawing war.
Yeah.
This also a very cool Simon Garfunkel song about that.
Which one?
Last Night I Dreamed the Strangest Dream. On the paper they were signed, he said they'd never fight again. Hey, it's a dream of the Kellogg-Briand Treaty.
Pete Seeger did that.
I only know from Simon Garfunkel, I confess. It's on, they could be singing a cover, I don't know. Very likely they're singing
What's
a cover.
What's the name of that song?
Last Night I Dreamed. Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream. Think like this.
So YouTube thinks that it's a Simon
Garfunkel. All right. Now, so the question is, of course, right? So the question of whether Israel is bound by the UN Charter, for example, right? This is a matter of much halakhic discussion. Okay, that's the background, right? That's the background of Israeli's thesis. So he sets out here, right? So based on his broad thesis that essentially all interpersonal relationships can be negotiated, right? Are subject to the social contract. Now he then makes the fairly enormous move that this right that he says, but you know, war involves killing people, and I would have thought killing people was not part of the space that was left open because I thought Lo Tirtzach kind of overcame this capacity for Haskalah. Right, that's what you might think, but he said, right, so don't tell me that international law legitimates war through Dina Malchus Adina, which is a social contract. That's ridiculous. That would mean that you could legitimate murder inside the state too, through Dina Malchus Adina. Oh wait, you can. Because
you can execute
the king can execute. Right, I can execute people who are not Chayiv Misa. Right, and that's where he, right, that's basically, at that point he's ready to go home. And at that point he's ready, he says, you know what? If Dina Malchus Adina lets the king execute people, right, who are not Chayiv Misa al pi halacha, that, right, and, right, whom the halacha, or at least whom you don't know are Chayiv Misa al pi halacha, then that means that, in fact, social con- you can stipulate to override, right, to override all, right, to override all interpersonally serve, and Latir Tzach is just an interpersonal Isser. Now, it follows from that, right, one minute, it follows from that, if you see the power of the king is simply the product of a social contract, and you see social contracts as enabling someone else to take your life, it follows that there's no particular reason that shouldn't work for individuals also, because there's nothing unique about the king. Right? The only thing that's unique about the king is that the king is entitled to presume your acquiescence, even if you have not signed the contract. And for that matter, the king is entitled to ignore your current non-acquiescence on the grounds that, well, you signed the contract long ago and butler died so. Right? Now, those are big moves. Right? Those are big moves. Right? The claim, right, because the claim that the reason the king can kill you is because you were maskim individually, when right now you're saying, no, don't kill me, I'm not vocal. Right, you were vocal back then. Right, that's a big move, right? But that's essentially the move he makes. And having said that, he says, well, this goes against Rav Zevin's thesis that you don't own yourself. The answer is you do own yourself. And in fact, there's no reason that we can't sign a contract in which I enable you to kill me. And therefore, certainly according to Israeli, I would think that boxing is entirely legitimate. Okay, so there were people waiting, but David had his hand up before.
I mean, his argument has become circular now.
Yeah.
Because he starts out with the assumption that the powers of the king of Israel are purely based on social contract.
Mm-hmm.
Shows that the king of Israel has the power to kill people who are not mitzvah based in,
mm-hmm.
and then goes on to say, therefore, we must own ourselves.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that?
But I only come to that conclusion if I started with the premise that it's based on social contract. He hasn't proven anything because he hasn't proven that premise. I assume that there are special dinim to the melech inherent in the melech Yisrael, then I've proven nothing.
That's true. If you're essentially in the other Melech Yisrael, you haven't proven anything. Now you have to go, you know, what justifies war?
I'm willing to say I'm Hashanami to that question. Who says war is justified?
Ah. So he claims that...
How you have that in
the Melech Mitzvah. So God commanded both your stuff. God can command the Mitzvah that overrides both your stuff. It's all God. But when it's not Melech Mitzvah, who says it's Mitzvah?
Which also good.
Again, I need Sanhedrin, I need possibly order of the school there, but again, you need a special heter from God to do any milchama.
So his response to that is that the halacha seems to legitimate acquisition by conquest. Right, that's his argument, right? The halacha seems to legitimate. Halacha does not accept the Geneva Conventions and believes that war acquired, that territory acquired by military aggression, in fact, belongs to the new owner. And his argument is that couldn't work if war were religion. Interesting question, but that's true.
The king is chal b'dieved doesn't mean it was mutter to do it.
That's right. I actually think the king may not be chal at all. That there's a wild gemara in Sukkah which says that you can't use hadassim purchased in Chutz Laretz,
right?
Because right, because everyone's a thief. So does that really mean, what do you see? Like, why is everything a thief? The answer is that all ownership, the only land that can be owned is Israel, because God gave that to us. All other land is just the product of serial conquest, so there's actually no Kenyan. Right, it's all land that Chutz Laretz is stolen. I think that may be the underlying premise.
Except the retort would just be the Gemara in Gittin, at Tiaru, which is what he quotes, Tiaru, right, Tiaru. Right,
Sihon. Well,
that is perfectly halakhically legitimate.
No, the Amun Law has no claims either.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I mean,
we're just replacing each other's Tiyanik Zila.
Okay, fine, but that's considered legitimate. But at least it works.
It works to do what? It works to eliminate the previous claim.
Right. it works to make it not considered the land of Al-Namoa.
Or do we care that it's Sichon and Ogzlan? No, no. It makes it right. It makes it eliminate the previous non-Kinyanim. It doesn't give you any rights. It just gets rid of the other people's rights.
Yes,
in the case of the Gemara, that it was, that it's not just, I mean, you can assume that when the Gemara is that the, when we're talking about the land of Al-Namoa, we don't mean the land of Al-Namoa, that's a scratch.
I mean, this
that's a real scratch.
Okay, let's figure out what the Easter is. We'll choose to burn. Ryan wanted to say, what is, Ryan, how is it to Lamar?
יש גמרא בסנהדרין שאומרת, האם יש דבר שמותר לגויים ושאסור לגויים ומותר ליהודים, ואומרת יש את יפה תואר, שמותר ליהודים ואסור לגויים, והנימוך, גויים לאבני כיבוש ניבו. ואיך מסבירים, יש ניגוד בין הגמרא הזאת לגמרא הזאת, אז כמה אחרונים להשפים את זה בצורה ש...
Useful. There's a there's a Chum Sofer is the counter position of the two, right? Right. There's a machlok. Right. That's all in the machlok between my Rabbi Broid and myself. We go through that whole dispute. Thank you. Glad that you should have remembered that. Okay, David, what do you want to say, Elliot?
Then,
that there is actually a Gemara which says Goyim Lav Nei Kibush Ninus. You have to figure out a way to reconcile those.
I would say is this question of.
Some Sofer says war is illegitimate.
The Machlokas, the Ksos and the Sivos, with Gzela after Gzela, is a Gzela which you're not punished for, or is not a Gzela, could be...
Sure, could also be no Gzela. Good. Elliot, what did you want to say?
I have a simple question. There's also, I think, the main problem with what the Israeli thesis about us coming for the king from that Rambam, because that Rambam also includes Beit Din Parak Shah.
True.
Which, even if you say that the Beit Din is based on the Koko contract,
yeah.
Parak Shah is definitely not based on my agreement. The only Beit Din in that hour can decide to kill me, even if I'm against
it. Interesting. Now the problem with this, of course, is that, we can play the same game of rules and exceptions. Right? If the rule is that Beit Din, the courts normally have to follow the law, but they have the right to break the law on occasion, as opposed to the king, who is only bound by his own executive decrees, then we're home free. Right? We can make the social. Right, the Rambam can just be described.
But
as
it's
social.
In the same halacha. You can't at some level. If it's in the same halacha, you have to assume that the precept behind both are the same.
Sure. The premise is you can do whatever the social contract agreed. It happens. The social contract set up different rules for the courts and the king.
You can do whatever you want that the social contract agrees. It's all. Make that argument at all,
yeah, but this is interesting because this is the halakha about breaking halakha. So halakha about breaking halakha is whatever we decided. And that's all I'm going to say. Now, that's in a sense that it's not a provable argument, but how do you ever prove what a social contract is? Right? Locke spends lots of time trying to prove to you what the social contract is with no what proves it? And there are always societies that don't function with it. Right. It's always going to be some kind of cultural bias as to who the civilized people are, right? And the people who don't follow the social contract, they're the barbarians. They don't count anyway. Right. They're the Rabach. Right. But the rest of us all have our mafkim to have smicha. Right? This is a big issue. Right? Rules of war are made up largely by powerful states, right? And they impose on a lesser state. There's no real agreement. Was the Pax Romana a Hescame? Right? Or just the Roman Empire saying, if all these rules, are we crush you? Right? Is that a social? It's not a willing social contract for sure.
It's always the only start war. It's always the only die.
Okay. But that I think is right. His brother Israeli thesis, and he tells right. And so he says is that Rav Zevin's thesis should not make it possible for people ever to negotiate their own lives away. And yet, we participate in a governmental structure in which people regularly negotiate, right, which we negotiate our own lives away. Now, I think there are lots of weak points in this, because as some of that we point out, actually, right, we have the asnasa problem in all these contracts. Right, let's say I belong to a state which which can execute people based on the following evidence, but of course I assume that means that evidence will never falsely point to me as a murderer. Right? If you come and say, do you really agree to follow the rules of the state?
if, right, under those circumstances, if you had known, had you known that the rules of the state would result in your being executed as a murderer, right, on the basis of inadequate evidence, would you have done so? You say, no, I recognize now that was a foolish decision. I would never have committed to that. I were not your nether. Right? Right, so, right, so, you know, here we have the problem, the halacha runs into the same problem, or at least the Israeli halacha runs into the same problem as all broad political philosophies. They're all built on fictions. Right, they're built on fictions of consent, and fictions, right, and right, and fictions of convention, and all sorts of things like that. And the question is, are we comfortable building halachot on those kinds of fictions? Or would we rather, you know, leave halacha grounded in the fact of Sinai? Right, that's all right, 'cause these, right, that I think is an important is an important question. Or Israeli is. I'm not sure that I am willing to. On the other hand, right, in contrast to this, it is always useful to present Socrates, who actually is willing to be bound by the social contract of the laws of Athens, even when they turn out executing him in his mind unjustly. Right. But the question is, to what degree Socrates is a real model of the way in which most people enter into contracts in their state, right, with their state, particularly when those contracts are all implicit and were actually entered into by their great-great-great-grandparents, right, that's a hard thing for me to deal with. Okay, that's the, right, that's the broader political theory. But again, for matters to us, as Rav Yisraeli thinks that this contrasts with Rav Zevin, because Rav Zevin says you can't own yourself, and he thinks that Rav Zevin's theory would make a social contract which enables enforcement, physical enforcement of the law, impossible. Because you should never be able to negotiate your right not to be whipped, and you should never be able to negotiate your right not to be killed. Okay, so that's high stakes. I don't know whether Rav Zevin, when he wrote his article, thought about that. In fact, Rav Zevin tells you, right, in his response, I think it's like one of the best moments, Rav Zevin says, I didn't write about this because it never occurred to me. Anyone would say anything like this. Hey, lo halal dot to Mishu Yomar. Right, right. Shelo Tirtzach, who's currently, they ask him up. Right, he's like, who was that? Right. You know, he's like, sort of like, you know, tearing his hair out at the notion that somebody would ever consider that possibility. So we have a fundamental, right, so that's, you know, that's a fundamental divide. That's a fundamental divide between Rav Yisraeli and Rav Zevin, and that, I think, is even more fundamental than the question of whether people own their bodies. It's that Rav Zevin imagines that all human relations fundamentally are governed by Torah. Right? And then there's, right, and the world outside Torah is this terrifying place which Torah tries to civilize. And Rav Yisraeli basically has a world in which the world is governed by human beings making arrangements among themselves, and when human beings fail to make arrangements among themselves, guess what? The Torah tells you what the default setting is. Right? They're very fundamentally different visions of the purpose of Torah. Yes?
So according to Rav Yisraeli, physicians, the suicide is completely one Torah if the government agrees to it?
It is possible that for Rav Yisraeli, that at least in a democratic society,
mm-hmm.
which legislates physician-assisted suicide, there's no issue.
We have to get the distinction between.
Although he may argue, well, okay, he may also argue that suicide per se is, right, is not an interpersonal matter, right? The irony is I can negotiate your right to kill me, but I can't necessarily negotiate my right to kill myself. My right to kill myself is not interpersonal.
Well, I mean, he says explicitly that he thinks suicide is mother for non-Jews.
Yeah, so we should say, his whole theory is, interpersonal relationships are negotiable, my own obligations to God are not negotiable, suicide and self-wounding are obligations to myself and therefore not subject to social contract. But allowing other people to wound me, allowing other people to kill me, that's an interpersonal relationship and that is perfectly, right, that is perfectly contractable. And then he has his last move. His last move is, but of course all this only applies to Jews.
Non-Jews.
Only applies to non-Jews, absolutely, right, because when it comes to, in terms of, right, the remaining prohibition against self-wounding and self-killing, right, because that is a matter not between you and somebody else, between you and God, that vanishes with regard to non-Jews. Now he needs this halakhically to explain, certain halakhas with regard to non-Jews. But having needed this, he then goes to town and says, and guess what? I'm perfectly happy with this because after all, why would we think that God owned non-Jews anyway? Because they have their Makor in the Olam HaGashmi. And our world, our neshama are in the Olam HaRuchani. So why would why would God be interested in them at all anyway? Essentially. Right? I think that's a not unfair description. Yes, David.
You may quote that theological idea in the end, but I don't think the fundamental halakhic shita is totally on believing that theology.
Okay, so what do you think the fundamental halakhic shita is totally on?
It's a question of ownership.
Yeah.
Does God own non-Jews? It doesn't mean they have to have a different soul for me.
Uh-huh.
It just happens to have the roots of an entirely different plane of existence.
No, they have the same body and the same soul that I did. Just God acquired all the Jews when he took them out of Egypt. He didn't do any acquisition on the non-Jews. So, non-Jews own their bodies and Jews don't?
The Mysakinia on Jews.
We are Jews are abundant of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The way Rav owns Zeved, God owns the Jews. Doesn't say anything about the theological origin of our souls.
Okay, so I had fun putting this part of Socrates on the Makor just to show you that he was holy. He thought that God owns the non-Jews also. He does, right? That's the point.
Locke also thinks God owns non-Jews.
Yeah, I didn't think it was so hard to find it, right? But I thought it was. I think it's hard to tell somebody who, to me, like that's like a good test. Could a Mishal Israeli tell this to Socrates? Right? Socrates says, "I see myself as the property of the gods." We say, "No." Israeli says, "No, autonomy." Right? Stop thinking of Socrates. Emancipate yourself from this. From this religion, run!
If you won't do it, I will.
The halakhic version of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which contemporary acronym. Me so great. All the art. Dang it. Okay. So I think that to me, right? So we have to evaluate Rabbi Israeli's piece on a number of levels. One is, do we find his vision of the relationship between Torah and proper society attractive or not? Right? Do we imagine that what should happen is we like Rav Zevin's vision that Torah always controls the world and then there's some spaces left over which Haskamah can handle? Or Rav Israeli's version in which the world is basically a social contract world and Torah rules where people let it in. Right? And it sets up some constraints on Jews and their behavior toward God. But really, all interpersonal relationships are open. Recognizing, right, you understand that has costs, but it also has gains, and that it enables one to legitimate non-halachic governance in Israel, among other places. Yes, David?
So, maybe this is the opposite intuition of everyone else in the room, but I can reasonably accept his distinction between the Jews and non-Jews. I have a lot of problems with his broad social contract theory.
Okay. All right, so that's a certainly reasonable position to take. I think that's a big issue. I think this is an issue which is core to one's whole conception of what the purpose of Judaism and Torah is. Okay, then you have a second question, which is if you live within his universe that way, and you think that actually all interpersonal relationships are negotiable. Do you think, right, are you comfortable with his distinction between Jews and non-Jews in this regard? Now, I think it follows, because if you think that really there's nothing wrong with the world being structured entirely by social contract, just something else got imposed on Jews, right? So that's all happened, right? Some minor additional stuff got imposed on Jews, so what's wrong with leaving the world the way it was before, right, for non-Jews? But we have to be aware that for him, this is a function of a worldview which sees Jewish souls as intrinsically different than non-Jewish souls. Yes.
I'm also not convinced that it needs to be a function of that worldview.
I didn't say it needs to be. I said for him.
I don't know if it is for him. Maybe he's just thinking there, like Plato throws Zevon in the middle term. Now, here's the Tanya, it's from your own sources, and even he says this.
That does not seem like it.
Yeah, it
didn't
seem like he was quoting the Tanya to rub it into Rebevin.
That's the line where it's like, oh, he's going to be the Tanya.
It sounds like he stated the fundamental thesis, and then he kind of brings the Tanya in as an afterthought.
Right. And like you could always say that, I mean, you could have all these differences between Jews and non-Jews be just halachic, metaphysical differences.
Not metaphysical.
Just legal differences,
Okay.
Because the legal differences are based on mitzvahs.
I think that you have to recognize this, where he's writing this in the context of legitimating reprisal raids, which have non-Jewish civilian casualties.
Right, so I don't agree with his broad social contract theory that justifies that.
Uh-huh.
His distinction in the realms of ownership, I'm willing to accept. I can accept that we need informed consent for non-Jews and not for Jews.
Well, that might end up being an outcome. I think if you're comfortable saying that, I have a suspicion that, he has data. Let's try the third level you have to evaluate is his specific data arguing for his thesis convincing, and particularly the primary piece of data that generates the distinction between Jews and non-Jews is the distinction in terms of Adas Baldin. Right, that we can kill non-Jews on the basis of confession and we can't kill Jews. Right, so you have to figure out whether that in itself is so compelling. Right, is that evidence? That evidence has to be explained either way if you take the position that non-Jews can be killed by a confession, which is a machlokas rishonim. Right, so do you think that his evidence for this is compelling? Yes.
So, I mean, this is where I'm confused. If one of the main points of this article is to try to legitimate the punishment given out by even a secular Jewish state, then how does the fact that, based on this, you're not allowed to kill Jews based on their confession, how does that help in a place where, let's say, the government has decided to want to execute the death penalty?
Bezdin can't kill you based on your confession. Bezdin can't do whatever he wants.
The social contract can go over all of this in the first place.
Right.
Why can't the social contract allow Beis Din to punish you?
It could.
But then there's really no difference between the Jews. There's really no difference between the Jews and the non-Jews, because if the non-Jews
we can't kill ourselves.
You're saying in practical terms, yes, in a secular state with a social contract, but in the ideal halakhic terms, yes.
We're still not, even in the halakhic state, we can't kill ourselves.
Yeah. Okay. I'll think about it.
Well, that's like, one of the issues that you brought up, where we talked about the Rambam, where he's talking about, we don't give you Mitzvah or Malchus on your own confession, because we think you might just be depressed and trying to get yourself killed.
Right.
Someone suggested that's only really needed for Bnei Noach, to explain why Bnei Noach aren't killed on their own confession.
Right, that was because for Jews and Jewish, at that point I said,
so I can maintain Rabbi Israeli's position without maintaining that I have to possibly say for Rafinah that non-Jews are killed on their own confession, based on as far like the Rambam that we just don't believe that.
Good. So I agree entirely that it is possible to reach Rabbi Israeli's conclusions about the difference between Jews and non-Jews without resorting to his ontological distinction between Jews and non-Jews, and I agree that it is probably possible to accept his theory of Adina Malchus Adina internally to the state without accepting his extension of it internationally. The issue is that's if I'm posketing entirely on my own. But if I go by authority, the question is, am I comfortable citing this article of Rabbi Israeli as an authoritative halachic source, if the context, if it's looked up, is an article that essentially says that there are ontological differences between Jews and non-Jews, which lead to fairly radical halachic distinctions among them.
The court here would disagree on half of it.
Okay. I think that's a comfortable position. I have, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm comfortable putting in a footnote to an article which not only makes such distinctions, but enjoys them.
You can quote his article and, agree with the Zvar.
Yeah, okay. So you quote it as an article as authority, quoting it as a footnote or as an authority? As an authority.
As an authority. Quote it as, let me get, I agree with this czar. I saw this czar here, and I'm going to use this czar here too.
Yeah, because most articles will say there's a machlokus between Rav Israeli and Rav Zevin.
Right.
Yes, Rav.
The other thing, if you do that, you have to ask Rav Israeli if you disagreed with his ontology, if he would still hold the position that he does.
Yeah, I don't think you can separate it from Rav Israeli. I think this is all tied into a particular religious Zionist ideology. And I think that's for him.
And if you can't separate them, then really you're just saying it yourself, and you have
to. I think that's right. I think you have to say, right, I think that...
The whole point, we are writing our own truth in here.
Well, writing your own shu'ud doesn't mean you don't quote authority. Again, we had that conversation, right? You know, you can write your own shu'ud, and your own shu'ud has your own authority. I have real trouble. I have real trouble with, I'm open about the conflict. On the one hand, I love the Zionist in me loves the social contract theory. The political theorist in me needs to find some way of figuring out how we run a state without on the basis of halacha, which just doesn't work in terms of criminal law. And so this is right. This is a variant of the Drushas Haran, which is so popular in Gush. The Drushas Haran, right, which is like one of the most, which is one of the popular things in Gush, says that halachic criminal law has no practical purpose at all. Its purpose is only to be Marid Hashefa Elokit El Ha'olam, to bring the divine effluence into the world. And it's not supposed to work. Right, the point where I always tell the story where I actually got accused of heresy in a shir at YU because I suggested the reason that Eidecha is Neman Bisurin is because it works. Right, I took a Rishon literally for saying that I forget who it is, Sassi Shannon, who says the reason, maybe it's Rashi even, who says that the reason that Eidecha is Neman Bisurin is because otherwise you couldn't eat your wife's cooking.
It's Rashi.
Sassi Shannon disagrees. Okay, right?
It's Rashi and Mamas.
Right, okay, right. So I said, look, Eidecha Neman Bisurin works because you have to be able to eat, able to deal with the cultural norms of time, you have to be able to eat your wife cooking. And I got an email where somebody accused me of being a kofer because by saying this, I was suggesting that halacha was supposed to work, and it clearly didn't. So I was mostly lost, Al-Tura. By suggesting, I kid you not, this was like a very impassioned email. It was like the coolest thing I was ever called a kofer for. For suggesting that halacha was supposed to work. But, right, in Gush, right, so the Drush of the Ron is very popular because the Drush of the Ron says that explicitly, right, halachic criminal law at least is not supposed to work. Right, the halachic criminal law gets most criminals off, but somehow it brings the divine effluence into the world, and then the king kills all the people who need to be killed anyway. Right, that's basically, I think it's not an unfair position. I never liked the Drush of the Ron because it seems to me to deny responsibility. But you understand, there's a certain attraction that it doesn't work very well, and so I tend to think that we'll paskin like different shittos when we have a halachic state, and we'll make it work. Yes.
I don't see why we're so resistant to assuming that there really are powers inherent in Malchut Yisrael that were meant to be part of the Torah system.
Because there's no control on them whatsoever. What, the power to kill anybody they want whenever they want without rules?
I'll go like Rav Israeli said. The power to kill anyone is higher than the Shemayim.
It's also still based on the fact that you have to trust them. As soon as you trust them, it takes the problem away.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not going there. I'm an untrusting person. You can always, all political systems are happily reducible to put the trustworthy person in charge.
This isn't just a political system.
So put them in charge of not only the politics, but the religion?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
it doesn't make it better.
It does if you trust it.
That's right. But all I'm saying, everyone understands that.
Yeah, do we trust Moshe Rabbeinu?
No, not really.
I don't know.
We never did.
But we're punished for that.
Okay, that's interesting. This is true. This is true. Moshe Rabbeinu goes back to God often, and God still backed him up. And it's got, I don't know, what should you have done if Moshe said hit the rock? Moshe said hit that rock there. God said hit that rock. Should you trust him? God didn't.
Should God have trusted Moshe?
No, should we have? I suppose Moshe called you, right? Said, Moshe, God just said hit that rock. Are you supposed to trust him?
Yeah.
All right. That is a fair question, right? Because, he wasn't always right. But also, I think that I guess I would argue that that the narrative is that after Moshe, right, Moshe is sort of God manifest in that sense that, right, you don't say Lo Bashamayim, well, Moshe is alive. But as soon as Moshe is dead, you say Lo Bashamayim for precisely that reason. Right, that there's no, right, you have, the point of Lo Bashamayim is that we no longer allow non-verifiable arguments. Now, you want to say Melech HaMashiach becomes Moshe again, I guess you can do that. But until that happens, I'm not
well,
convinced.
It's like the Ralbag that you quoted in one of your weekly emails, that,
yeah,
that this is Lo Kam
Yisrael
Moshe, that the Ralbag says, but
Mashiach will be better. Yeah, Mashiach.
Kam Vuhu Ta'olam, who is that Melech HaMashiach?
Yes, you are right that the Ralbag takes that position. The Ralbag's a really interesting thinker. Melech HaMashiach will be greater than Moshe.
No, but you said
yes, because he thinks Melech HaMashiach is not, Moshe Rabbeinu was
the Israel.
Was a Navi just for Israel. He thinks Melech HaMashiach will be a Navi for the whole world.
It's interesting.
No, not that he'll be a Goy, but that he'll be a Navi for Goy.
Yeah. Yeah. He can do lots of things that make Mashiach universalist. That's a particular chiddush that makes him greater than Moshe. But Ralbag says all sorts of interesting things. All sorts of really interesting things. Most of which it's not necessarily wise to believe.
That's your polite way of saying fear and Gemara.
There's a Rosh Hashiva at YU.